This is now the third speech, but it would be useful to recap the first and second speeches. If you recall, the first speech of Elihu brought a fresh insight to bear upon the nature of affliction as God administers it. And what is that fresh what does it amount to, this fresh insight? It is really fresh, at least for Job it was, and it's certainly so for us too. And it is fresh because we tend to equate affliction in a punitive context. Crime, punishment. Sin, likewise punishment. But what Elihu has to say sheds a new light on this whole subject, because he explains that affliction as God administers it is not merely punitive, that is not always a punishment value attached to it, but rather it may be disciplinary in nature, because human beings have a natural tendency to slide towards sin. Now the point is this: God need not do that. God need not discipline His children. He has no obligation to do so, because He is, after all, the judge. And all God needs to do to make life easy for Him, so to speak, is to sit back and watch us slide into sin, and at the right time execute judgment, and He would be perfectly correct in doing so. You could not compel God to intervene in the whole process, but God does intervene, and herein we see the love of God displayed. Whenever and wherever God chastens a child of God, it is always a demonstration of His compassion, of His love, of His concern for that person. Hence, this reinforces the lesson that Elihu had tried to bring across to his audience of four, namely that affliction must not be automatically equated to punishment, but affliction should be understood in a broader context, that of a discipline. And if it is a discipline, there is an objective attached to it, and the objective being the maturing, the spiritual maturing of the individual. As far as those times are concerned, besides the discipline of affliction, and indeed the ministry of dreams, as we saw in the case of Abimelech, an unbeliever, and of course Abraham, God would also, as He saw fit, dispatch a heavenly mediator to deliver a person from the drawing, the suction of sin. And we saw the important role of this mediator, and we discuss arguments to illustrate or to demonstrate the fact that this heavenly mediator could not be just an ordinary angel, it would have to be the angel of the Lord. So that's the first speech. In the second speech, Elihu starts out by summarizing Job's thesis in four major points. What are these four points? First is Job's claim to innocence. Second, the claim that God has denied justice to Job. The third claim, God has treated Job as if he were a liar. And the fourth claim, that God has suddenly turned hostile towards Job, as manifested by the many afflictions that God has sent upon this unfortunate man, particularly the physical afflictions, the boils and the sores and the ulcers that have appeared all over his body. Elihu then goes on to develop his case that, appearances notwithstanding, God is always fair and just. And to say that is not enough, an argument has to be given, and Elihu does give a very detailed argument to buttress this point. The crux of his argument, that God is always fair and just, even though appearances may seem to indicate otherwise, the crux of his argument is as follows. Firstly, justice and the power to rule are conjoined in one and the same person, the person of the ideal ruler, meaning to say that it would be impossible for a ruler who does not respect justice to govern. Bear in mind that this was certainly true in the prevailing perception of those times, because in those times the power to rule and justice were conjoined in the person of the ideal ruler, were conjoined in one single human being. In later times, and in our times certainly, the functions, the judicial, the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branches of government are quite distinct and separate. So we would have trouble comprehending the perspective that Elihu delivered, but it was the ruling perspective in the ancient world. Important point for us to appreciate is that in those times, at least, a ruler who did not respect justice could not govern. It was not possible. He could not fulfill the demands of the office. Point one. Point two, justice is without doubt the foundation of God's rule, meaning to say that God never over-punishes, God never under-punishes, God does not leave any piece of evidence unexplored, and certainly God's timing, maybe not our timing, but God's timing is always spot on. So here comes the punchline of the argument. If Job is correct in asserting that God is at times unjust, then in the light of the previous premises, it must follow that God cannot be all-powerful. Remember what was said earlier, justice and the power to rule are conjoined. So if God does not respect justice, meaning to say he is at times unjust, as Job has claimed, then God cannot have the power to rule. He cannot be all-powerful. But Job has never wavered from his belief that God is all-powerful. Conclusion: it has to be, therefore, that Job is mistaken in his first premise. The first premise being that at times God may bypass justice. So that premise cannot hold. This line of argument is what we would call in logic a syllogism. The major premise, the minor premise, and the conclusion. If any one of the two premises is flawed, the conclusion is anybody's guess. So, in the light of this argument, Elihu insists that very much to the contrary, God does judge all human beings with strict impartiality and by the same set of laws. There's no such thing as one set of laws for this group and another set for another group. Why is God able to judge all human beings with strict impartiality? Because nothing can be hidden from him. All things are naked and open before the eyes of him. Therefore, if there is any wicked or corrupt leader, then that person will never escape the public manifestation of the wrath of God. According to Elihu, therefore, Job, by his constant complaint of unfair treatment by God, has actually added to his former sin, whatever the former sin may have been that invited all these afflictions upon him. By his constant whining and complaining of unfair treatment by God, Job has unwittingly added to that former sin a new sin, the new sin being rebellion, which may, as Elihu warns, which may bring about even more severe repercussions. So in a way, he's telling Job politely, watch your words. If you carry on complaining about unfair treatment by a just and righteous God, you are actually guilty of rebellion. The fact that, and then he goes on to present this observation rather. The observation is that, Job, you have been complaining about no answer from God, but does it occur to you that it is your complaining spirit itself that may be a big factor in God delaying his response to you? And this is really a new perspective. We have not thus far come across it in this book. So young though he was, he does have a lot of sense in what he says. He says it very forthrightly, to the point that we may be even shocked that a younger man would speak so bluntly to an older man. But in the final lesson in this series, I will advance an opinion as to why he dared to do so. Until then, I keep you waiting. Now we come to the third speech of Elihu, which takes up the whole of chapter 35. This third speech can be broken into two parts. Verses 1 through 4 deal with the rights of Job, at least as he has claimed those rights. And then verses 5 through 16 deal with God's sovereign rights. Here is Job claiming my rights, and here are the sovereign rights of God. And the two are put one against the other. How does Elihu approach this subject? He does it in a very logical way. He starts out by quoting or citing the very words used by Job in order to summarize Job's position. And in a dispute or in an argument, this is indeed a very useful strategy to adopt. What better way of summarizing an opponent's position than by citing his own words? He then takes the role of a advocate for God by defending God's sovereign justice against the position as presented by Job. So he starts out in verse 2 in this manner. Thinkest thou, addressing Job, thinkest thou this to be right, that thou saidst, my righteousness is more than God's? Actually, if you look carefully at the book, you will find that Job had not literally used this terminology. True. But the words that he had used, and they were copious words indeed, amounted to exactly the same thing. So whether or not he literally said, my righteousness is more than God, he had implied that by the many claims that he had made. After all, if you think back, how had Job approached this subject? He had been dwelling at length on his righteous lifestyle, his integrity, his care for his employees and slaves, his compassion for the needy in the community, his hospitality towards strangers. So really, he is highlighting, even if he didn't intend to, he is highlighting or giving prominence to all the good things that he has done in thought, word, and deed. His righteousness, in other words. Moreover, Job had frequently questioned, and this no one can doubt, Job had frequently questioned whether God had been fair and just in dealing with him, specifically in sending wave after wave of affliction upon him, because he had, so he says, done nothing to merit such treatment. Such sentiments as these, and this is another reason why we need to be careful about our words, because our words may convey more meaning than we intend. This was certainly true of Job, because if you put together all these statements of Job and look at it in the light of what does this all amount to, it is hard to avoid the conclusion that it amounts to Job claiming that he was in effect more righteous than the God who dwells on high. And that is a very staggering claim which nobody should even dream of doing. Thinkest thou this to be right, that thou saidst, my righteousness is more than God's? Verse 3, for thou, referring to Job, said, again he's quoting the words of Job to buttress what was said in verse 2. For thou, that is Job, said, what advantage will it be unto thee, that is to himself, Job, and what profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sin? Again, did Job literally make such statements? What does it profit me to be free of my sin? Not quite, but then his words could easily be construed to mean the same thing. If you go back to chapter 9, verse 22, I will cite a verse that proves this point, that Job's words amounted to what Elihu described them as meaning. Chapter 9, verse 22. This is one thing, therefore I, Job, said it, he, God, destroys the perfect and the wicked. Now if this is true, if God destroys the perfect and the wicked, then God is not entirely fair. And therefore God's righteousness cannot be as great as he has claimed it to be. So we need to be really careful about our words, because it is when the words have issued from our mouth, it is very hard later on when challenged to say, I didn't mean it, because the audience, the recipient of your words, can place, if three or four interpretations can be placed upon the words that you speak, rest assured that in an audience there will be those three or four different interpretations of what you have said, and all would be correct in the sense that they would fairly and justly follow from what you have said. But there you are claiming that you never intended it to mean that way. Too bad. Those meanings, whether you intended or not, are attached to the particular form of words that you use. And this was the case with Job. For us, the lesson is, be very careful in what you say, particularly when you are emotionally distraught, because you will live to regret what you say, particularly when you are emotionally very distraught, as Job was. And indeed, he eventually had to accept that he had spoken without knowledge. When God finally spoke to him directly, he did have to acknowledge that he had spoken out of turn and that his words were not right. Here Elihu is warning him, the words that you have spoken, Job, really amount to something rather serious, that you are claiming your righteousness is more than God's. If you go back again to chapter 9, verse 22, that verse amounts to claiming that God does not seem to pay attention to the state of rectitude or of sin in a man's life. In other words, if this is true, it shouldn't make any difference how you live your life, because good or bad, God is going to treat you in a way that is quite haphazard. So why go to all the trouble to be right, to be good, if that is the case. Again, in Job's defense, we have to say that the words that he had spoken were spoken in times of deep emotional distress. And under those conditions, he did express himself in this manner, inviting this rebuke from Elihu. Thinkest thou this to be right that thou saidst, that you implied, in other words, my righteousness is more than God's, for thou saidst, what advantage will it be unto thee, that is to himself, to be good? What profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sin? Now, having defined the position of Job by using Job's own words, Elihu takes it upon himself to act as the advocate for God, to defend God's position. And here I would like to inject a personal observation, because the book of Job is largely poetic in structure, and although it is part of the inspired and preserved canon, it is still written by a human being, and it therefore has a certain structure, in this case poetic. And as an epic poem structured in that way, there are certain poetic devices used which facilitate the flow of the argument. And one of these strategies that is adopted is this way of introducing a person in a certain role. Elihu is now going to take on the role of God's advocate, and in order to do that, the way has to be prepared for him to speak in that capacity. So he starts out in chapter 35 verse 4 with this statement, I will answer thee and thy companions with thee. If you think about it, that statement really should come from God, but God is silent up till now. So Elihu seems to have taken it upon himself, having cited the position of Job using Job's own words and shown how glaringly wrong that position is, he is now going to speak for God. And this poetic device, which now allows him to speak freely in a different role, the role of a self-appointed advocate for God, is a device that much later on in religious poetry was used effectively by various poets. And one of the best examples I can think of is none other than Milton in his great poem Paradise Lost. Allow me to cite these verses from the opening portion of book 1. Milton writes, and Milton, don't forget, is writing from a Christian perspective, and chiefly thou, O Spirit, that dost prefer before all temples the upright heart and pure, instruct me, for thou knowest that to the height of this great argument I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. Here again is the same device. In order to embark on this great theme of his, Milton, the theme being the explanation, what he calls justify, the explanation of God's dealings with men. In order to embark upon this grand theme, he has to have an introduction that allows him to speak in that role. And we find the same structure, poetic structure, used by Elihu when he says in chapter 35 verse 4, I will answer thee and thy companions with thee. Don't forget that Eliphaz back in chapter 22 had actually attempted the same thing. However, Eliphaz had allowed himself to become sidetracked into framing accusations against Job. He wanted to do what Elihu later did, but as he went on, Eliphaz became sidetracked into framing accusations. Give you some examples. Chapter 22, reading from verses 1 through 4. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, Can a man be profitable unto God, as he that is wise may be profitable unto himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that thou art righteous, or is it any gain to him, the Almighty, that thou makest thy ways perfect? Will he reprove thee for fear of thee? Will he enter with thee into judgment? And so on. The so on portion, which is the bulk of Eliphaz's speech, unfortunately consists of unfounded accusations, which of course vitiate what Eliphaz started to do. That task is now taken on and carried through, properly carried through by Elihu. He is doing two things, bear in mind. He is showing the error of Job's arguments, in particularly in complaining about the apparent injustice of God. And at the same time, Elihu is speaking up as an advocate for God, defending the ways of God with man, particularly in this area of the silence of God. And we will see later on why, in some cases, your prayers are not answered, why in some cases we pray and cry out to God and we are met with nothing more than silence from God. Elihu actually gives us a profound insight into why that could be so. So Elihu stays focused. He doesn't go into framing accusations against Job, but rather he carries on with his theme, which is the sovereign rights of God. What is Elihu's aim in talking about the sovereign rights of God? His aim is this: to demonstrate to Job and to the three friends of Job that God is so far above human beings, he is so exalted that he cannot be affected, nor can he be swayed in his judgment by the conduct of man. Implying that Job is wrong in saying that if I do good, I can expect reward. If I do bad, I can automatically expect punishment. And lo and behold, it doesn't work out that way. Therefore, God is unfair. Elihu is saying God and God's ways can in no way be affected or influenced by what man does or doesn't do. Chapter 35, verses 5 through 7. Look unto the heavens and see, and behold the clouds which are higher than thou. Implying that if the clouds are so far above us standing on the surface of planet Earth, and if the heavens are even higher than that, think that God is above the clouds and the heavens. In other words, he is so exalted that he is not going to be affected by what you and I do. Therefore, God's judgment cannot be influenced or modified by what you and I do. Therefore, God's judgments are always impartial, perfect, complete, leaving nothing unattended. It follows, therefore, if thou sinnest, verse 6, what doest thou against him? Or if thy transgressions be multiplied, what doest thou unto him? If thou be righteous, what givest thou him? What receiveth he, God, of thine hand? Since God cannot be influenced in any way in his judgment by what man does or doesn't do, it therefore must follow that God treats all human beings in a strictly impartial manner. And God is not obliged to explain why he does certain things or why he withholds himself from doing certain things. Verse 8 of chapter 35. Thy wickedness may hurt a man as thou art, and thy righteousness may profit the son of man. What this means is this: Elihu draws Job's attention to the manner in which we human beings conduct our relations with one another, how do we conduct these relationships one person with another? It is, to be very honest with ourselves, it is done on a basis which, to put it crudely, can be expressed in the following way. You scratch my back and I will scratch yours. There is a lot of truth in this simple statement. Very often, all too often, the good that we do for others is motivated by an expectation that the like would be done to us when we need it. But can this be the way that human beings deal with God, or is this the way God deals with us? Does He do something for our benefit so that we can do something for God's benefit, maybe promote His glory? No way at all. What Elihu is saying is, because God is so exalted, so far above the plane on which human beings live and work and play, therefore God cannot be constrained by this kind of principle in dealing with human beings. You scratch my back, I will scratch yours. Therefore, Elihu says, if ever you receive any reward or blessing from God, please don't think you deserve it, but understand that it is given to you purely on account of God's grace and mercy. On the other hand, and this is a difficult part to accept, on the other hand, if and when you are afflicted, then it is either because you deserve it, that is, it is punitive, or there is a specific disciplinary value in it. Think of the thorn in the side that Paul had and which was never removed. He did nothing by our standards that would merit that kind of affliction, and it obviously troubled him a lot. Yet God refused to remove it so as to keep him humble. Therefore, affliction very often has a disciplinary objective and value, and it must not always be seen in the light of a punishment. Verse 9. By reason of the multitude of oppressions, they make the oppressed to cry. They cry out by reason of the arm of the mighty. The common view which is contained in this verse, and it's a view that Job and his friends had entertained, is that afflicted persons are weighed down, even crushed, and yet so often God doesn't seem to step in to provide relief. This silence of God, from Job's point of view, encourages the wicked even as it discourages the suffering righteous. And if you leave that viewpoint unchallenged, it can lead us into grievous sin if you hold on to that kind of view, that the silence of God encourages the wicked even as it discourages the suffering righteous. So Elihu says, no, such language grossly misrepresents the manner in which God runs the world that He has created. The correct explanation for the state of affairs, why so often when we are caught up in suffering and we cry out for relief, we are met with silence. The correct explanation for this state of affairs, according to Elihu, is that those who are afflicted, and it may be difficult for you to receive it, those who are afflicted tend to be so preoccupied with their misery that they fail to practice proper intercessory prayer. Just because you cry out to God, Lord, I'm suffering, grant me relief, that does not automatically make it an intercessory prayer. It could well be a statement that you are so preoccupied with your misery and suffering that you are crying out to God. So that construction does not automatically qualify as a proper intercessory prayer. A proper intercessory prayer requires, yes, an acknowledgement of your suffering, but it requires you to step aside from yourself, as it were, in order to be able to petition God. If you are so closed in, so preoccupied, so focused on my affliction, my suffering, my pain, how on earth, according to Elihu, how on earth can you pray a proper intercessory prayer? Don't forget that a proper intercessory prayer must include praise and thanksgiving. If you are so preoccupied with your misery and suffering, how on earth, according to Elihu, are you going to praise God and offer thanksgiving to Him? That would be the furthest thing from your mind. So what would be an example of a proper intercessory prayer? We have many such examples in the book of Psalms, one such being Psalm 31. Now, there is a prerequisite to praying an effective intercessory prayer, and that prerequisite is this: you have to come to God without any terms and conditions. Did Job cry out to God without any terms and conditions? Unfortunately, not all the time, because more often than not, his approach to God, and quite understandably so, is conditioned by the perception, rightly or wrongly, the perception that he is righteous, his afflictions, he doesn't deserve them, and now he's crying out for relief. But what Elihu says is, even if you think you are righteous, even if you are convinced that you don't deserve the suffering that God has sent, you cannot bring this baggage with you when you try to pray for relief, when you make an intercessory prayer. You have to dump this baggage and come to God without any preconceptions of yourself and the fact that you are righteous and you don't deserve all of this. In other words, you have to come to God as you are, in humble submission, acknowledging that there may well be secret sins in you. As David said in Psalm 139, "Search me, O God, and try me, and see if there be any wicked way in me." That has to be the state of heart and mind that must prevail if you are to pray a proper intercessory prayer. If, according to Elihu, you do not have this preparation of mind and heart when you pray, then don't be surprised if you are met with nothing more than the silence of God. And indeed, it speaks to us also how often in our afflictions, in our troubles, we cry out to God for relief, and how often we complain later on, "I have been met with nothing but silence from God. I've prayed and prayed, I've asked my friends to pray, and nothing seems to happen, no answer from God." Well, take a leaf out of the book of Elihu. Examine yourself. Are you praying in the right way? Or are you coming to God with certain preconceptions about yourself? If you have that kind of baggage, then certainly God is not going to hear. Well, God will hear, but He's not going to answer, which means that you will be met with nothing but silence. By contrast, where a petitioner approaches God with the right spirit, he will obtain grace to sing in the night season, that is to say, during times of affliction. As seen, excuse me, the best example I can find of people who in the midst of affliction, because they had prepared themselves to pray to God or to approach God in the right spirit, found grace to sing even in their times of affliction. The best examples I can think of are Paul and Silas. If you look at Acts chapter 16, reading from verse 23 onwards, Acts 16 verse 23, and when they had laid many, it's an interesting word, many stripes upon Paul and Silas, they cast them into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely. Who, that is the jailer, having received such a charge, thrust them into the inner prison, the most secure part of the jail, and made their feet fast in the stocks. That is to say, either lock their feet in the stocks or attach heavy planks to their feet so that they couldn't run away easily. And don't forget, Paul and Silas had been scourged. Now, remember what I said, the many stripes is an interesting word, because the people who had done the scourging of Paul and Silas were not Jews. By Mosaic law, Jews were limited to applying no more than 40 strokes, but the Romans were not so constrained. So it was up to the person administering the punishment to deliver as many strokes as he deemed fit. So it wouldn't be surprising if Paul and Silas had been scourged more than 40 times, which means that to lie down on the floor to sleep would have been next to impossible because of the pain on the back. So instead of complaining and moaning as Job did, what did Paul and Silas do? Okay, I can't sleep because of the pain of the wounds on my back. I can't lie down. My feet are encumbered by these heavy planks. I can't sit. I can't cross my legs. What can I do? I can stand upright. Is my voice hindered? No, my voice is not hindered. So what can I do standing upright? Complain? No. Sing praises unto God and thank God that the situation is not worse than it could be. You know, to have to be able to do that, given the situation Paul and Silas were in, required extraordinary grace. And what Elihu is saying is, although he didn't have the benefit although he didn't have the benefit of the New Testament perspective, he was correct in this, that if you do not prepare your heart and mind, you will not receive any answers to prayer. So you are only doing yourself an injustice to carry on with the spirit of complaining about God to God. Yes, Job and his friends and Elihu didn't have the benefit of the New Testament perspective, but we do. So it is incumbent upon us to draw principles from the passage we have just read in Acts chapter 16. There are clearly principles from the behavior of Paul and Silas under those circumstances, which Job could have applied had he been aware of them. Of course he wasn't, but we can be aware because all these are contained in the Word of God. And therefore we would be the loser if we didn't elucidate those principles and then apply them ourselves. What are these principles that would help us in times of trouble? Principle number one. Please understand that the believer's source of equanimity, that is to say inner peace and stability and joy, cannot depend upon any external factors. Why? because external factors or circumstances can change, can vanish very quickly. So if your peace and joy depends upon those factors, the moment those factors are removed or changed, then your peace and joy is all shattered. Secondly, as Paul and Silas demonstrated, even under oppressive circumstances, even during times of physical pain and suffering, nothing should destroy a believer's inner peace and calm, because nothing can ever separate that believer from the love of God. Romans chapter 8, verses 36 to 39. And I believe it was that awareness that no matter what may happen to this body, I am safe in the arms of Jesus. It was that which gave Paul and Silas the courage to stand on their feet and sing in the midst of the most painful circumstances of their life. Third principle is this. We spoke about inner peace, but bear in mind that without a clean conscience, you cannot have that inner peace. Therefore, a clean conscience is a prerequisite to inner peace. Job, by and large, did have a clean conscience, but his problems were not that of black marks upon his record. His problems were quite different, as we have discussed. And the fourth principle is this, which Job may not have fully appreciated, but which we should appreciate because we have the benefit of the full revelation of God. Any believer with a clear conscience has at all times ready access to the throne of grace simply by virtue of his faith in the one living and true God. You do not have to go through any convoluted path to find grace to help in time of need. Your faith automatically entitles you to that benefit. More often than not, however, the afflicted person like Job does not come to God in the right spirit, the spirit of unqualified submission, and therefore relief is denied him. Chapter 35 of Job, verses 10 and 11. Exactly the problem which Job experienced because he did not come in a spirit of total submission. None saith, where is God, my maker, who giveth songs in the night, who that is God, teacheth us more than the beasts of the earth, and maketh us wiser than the fowls of heaven. Bear in mind that what is required is a spirit of submission, not a spirit of resignation. A spirit of resignation is defeatist. It is equivalent to saying, I have to submit to God because I have no other way, no other choice, so I might as well do it. That is a spirit of resignation, and that is not going to get you anywhere with God. A spirit of submission is something in which your whole heart and mind are poured into it, and you are willing and you want to submit to God, even though you may not understand why these particular afflictions have come upon you. Why is there a reference in verse 11 to the beasts of the earth and the fowls of the air? And the expression or the teaching that God makes us wiser than the beasts of the earth and the fowls of the heaven. If you look at animals and birds and such like creatures, when they suffer in dumb silence because they are unable to articulate their sufferings to God. They don't have that link to God. They can only suffer in silence, not comprehending what is happening to them. But human beings are not so. They can articulate their suffering, their needs, to someone that is so far above them. In other words, their Creator. And this is an immense privilege and it should demonstrate to Job and to his friends that God really cares for them. Otherwise, he would not have given them that privilege of being able to reason, think, articulate their needs to God. Pride in the heart of man, unfortunately, is not put down by affliction. So according to Elihu, this may be an additional factor to explain why the sufferer fails to elicit any response from God. Verse 14, although thou, Job, sayest thou shalt not see him, God, yet judgment is before him, God, therefore trust thou in him. What Elihu is saying to Job in this verse is this: the mere fact that God is not perceptible to the senses of man does not mean, or should not be construed to mean, that therefore God keeps himself apart, distances himself from human beings. He is in fact very involved in the lives of all human beings, good or bad. After all, God, by his own declaration, has said he is a God of justice who will always uphold the right and put down the wrong. Therefore, since even though we may not see it as happening, it remains a fact, because God has said so, that he is intimately involved in the affairs of human beings to the extent that he will always uphold the right and always put down the wrong. Therefore, Job, according to Elihu, should simply trust God like a child and bring his petitions before God and wait patiently upon God. But Job had not fully appreciated this lesson, because if you remember, his behavior indicated that he was really excessively anxious. He need not have been excessively anxious to have God demonstrate in a dramatic and public way that God had accepted him back. But really, understandable though it may have been, Job had no right to demand that. If God saw fit to give that kind of public attestation to Job, good for him. But if God saw fit to do it in a still, quiet way that is equally effective anyway, Job had no right to demand of or expect of God that because of all this suffering, now God should do something dramatic to show to everybody in the community that Job is back on his pedestal. Elihu says, sorry, Job, you don't have a right to do that. The extent of your suffering, unmerited though it may be, does not entitle you to make that kind of demand upon God. Not even you have the right to do that. It's a rather tough lesson to be taught by a younger person, but it is the fact, it is the truth. Now we come to a very difficult verse, the penultimate verse in the chapter, verse 15. But now, because it is not so, he hath visited in his anger, yet he knoweth it not in great extremity. What we have here is a literal rendition into English of the Hebrew. The problem is the original Hebrew is itself, the Hebrew construction is very difficult to understand. The only thing that can help us here is the context. And therefore, relying on the context, we can come up with the following construction to explain the meaning of this verse. And that construction goes like this. The fact that God has visited you, Job, with affliction, says Elihu, must be seen in the light of what you really deserve. But God has refrained from taking cognizance of the full scope of your sins, so that your present afflictions are actually less than what he could justifiably have applied in your case. There is therefore no cause for you, Job, to complain about receiving unmerited afflictions. That is the best way I can suggest to understand verse 15. And now, and by the way, that interpretation of verse 15 is consonant with the concluding verse of the chapter, verse 16. Therefore doth Job open his mouth in vain. He multiplieth words without knowledge. Elihu's conclusion is that the complaints voiced by Job bearing upon the severity of his affliction vis-a-vis his track record, these complaints are groundless before a just and holy God. And on that note, Elihu ends his third speech. Next week, God willing, we will do the fourth and final speech of Elihu, and after that will come the finale of the book, the words of God, and the restoration of Job.